Once more into the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. And hopefully I'm actually on the air. This last hour at this point, I did all of my introduction and I felt very proud of myself for saying my own name. And then I had to do it all over again. But hopefully it worked this hour. This hour I have an interesting subject. I like to look at the changes over time, where we are in history, what does it imply based on the past. One of my favorite quotes from Samuel Clemens, otherwise known as Mark Twain, is history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. So I'm constantly looking for rhymes in history and comparing it. Is this really a rhyme, or is this kind of a random rhyme, or is there like some meter to this? Is there a reason for this happening again? And quite often, those rhymes tend to happen when we've forgotten what caused it to happen the last time around. Maybe we didn't even know it had happened the last time around, or if we knew, it was in a way that we didn't really catalog it as a memory. So what am I talking about? Well, demographics is a big part of this. Oh, good. I've been told you can hear me out there. You knew you could hear me, but I didn't know you could hear me. Now I know you can hear me. And if you can't hear me, well, you can't hear me laugh at you for not listening. All right. So demographics. How many people we're making in the world, where they're living, what kind of income they get, why they move from one place to another. This is fascinating, and it's part of economics. So I'm going to go back to the kind of the beginning of the 20th century and walk through the progression of what's happened in demographics. And I think a lot of you are going to recognize points here and go, Okay, so at the turn of the 20th century, we've got a new century here. 1901 rolls around. The expansion of the United States across the continent was finished. There was this industrial activity that was really kicking off. Steel was being manufactured at a rate that had never been seen before. That the Americans were taking this, U.S. steel became the dominant steel manufacturer on the planet until it became close to the only steel manufacturer on the planet. And through some rather cutthroat business practices. Just as a reference, Andrew Carnegie, who was the owner of U.S. Steel, was the richest man in the world at the time. And if you were to compare him inflation adjusted to today, he would be the only trillionaire. He'd be in the multi-trillions, which means if you take all of the other billionaires that exist on the planet and put them together, they would equal less than what his net worth was. He was wealthy on a scale that we don't really have a reference for. So that's going on in the 20th century. The steel manufacturing was taking off. People started coming to the city from the rural area. They're leaving the farm to come into manufacturing. It's dirty, it's messy, but mom, it's dirty and messy on the farm too. So they go to work in the coal plants. They go to work in the coal mines. They go to work in the steel refining and in the iron mines. And so we started producing a lot of metal because we were building skyscrapers in New York. We were building skyscrapers in Chicago. There was no place on the planet that had skyscrapers but the United States. So we needed a lot of steel. We were developing new methods of growing that. This was attracting people off the farm. People were leaving the farm in waves, coming to the city to work in manufacturing. Working on automobiles, working on tractors. Well, this is drawing a lot of people in. This is the Roaring Twenties now. We had World War I in the middle of that, and that introduced a lot of people that had been on the farms to industrialize stuff. The first time they'd ever been in a automotive vehicle was because they were in the army from the draft. And they realized, hey, there's something more here. This is a lot better than riding a mule or than walking from Austin to Georgetown in a day so that you can have a business meeting the next day and then walk back. This was a That's how business got done back then. You had to plan way in advance. So the demographic shift was very real. People got a taste for the convenience of living in big cities, so they started moving to the big cities. As that happened, more and more manufacturing took place. Now the tractor comes back out, the automobile, the truck. You know, you think the milkman that's going out and delivering the milk in the morning. The reason was because we didn't have refrigerating. We didn't have a lot of automobiles in general. So it was a horse-drawn cart going out across the neighborhood delivering milk on the front porches. That's kind of an alien concept today. Why would somebody put milk on your front? If you stepped outside your door today and somebody had put a gallon of milk on your porch, you might be upset. Well, this was a family activity in the morning. Johnny, go get the milk from the porch. Unless Johnny was up at 1 a.m. to help with the delivery. So demographics are starting to change. The suburbs start to form. They're pretty small at this point because everybody's living in the inner city. The tractor goes out. People start losing their jobs en masse. So in the year 1900, 80% of the workforce. Now, the workforce in 1900 didn't include women in any of the statistics. They weren't allowed to vote, and they weren't really considered workable. So come forward. A lot has changed since then in a very good way. But 80% of the workforce was on the farm, agriculture. In the year 2000, 2% of the workforce was on the farm. And now it's closer to 0.2%. So that's a demographic shift. As the tractor went out into the farms, the farmers that were just the hands, they were just out there, they were the migrant population, or maybe they had their own farm, and it was small, but it was profitable enough when you could sell to the locals. Well, with a tractor, one person can do what 20 people were doing. So 20 people or 19 people lost their jobs. It didn't happen overnight, but it happened over a decade. This is what we call the Great Depression. We instituted tariffs, but the tariffs weren't really effective at all on fixing the problem of unemployment because you still only needed one person on one tractor to do what 20 people did before. That didn't change. So we had this massive flow out of rural America. If you think of this like the breathing, the exhaling from the rural side toward the cities. You had this mass migration in the United States. And that's not an unusual thing. Only 20 years before there'd been another one, and 20 years before that, another one. The pilgrimage across the United States before it was the United States, across the continent, the Oregon Trail, all of that. These are mass migration waves. Well, the last big mass migration wave was out of the farm and into the city. The entire structure of how we think and do business changed based on that change. Okay, then over time, it got way, way too expensive to live in the middle of the city. That's where everybody wanted to live, but it got way too expensive to live there. This was the place where anybody could walk to work. You were nearby all of the major transportation. It's a great place to be until it got too expensive, and that started making the suburbs grow. So now we've moved forward to the 40s, 50s, and 60s. The suburbs are growing. Through the 40s and 50s, you've got this new concept. The American dream is now a white picket fence. It wasn't there before. You had a farm in the American dream before that. Now it's a white picket fence with a little yard and a little house, and it's in a line of other white picket fenced houses. And this was really, really cool because it hadn't existed before. You didn't have this in any other time in history. So suburbs are growing. People are saying, yeah, you don't want to live in the inner city. It's too expensive. The only people that live there are really, really wealthy. Well, as fewer people lived in the inner city, fewer and fewer services were offered as convenience in the inner city. Those services moved out to the suburbs. It was a bigger marketplace. So the price of real estate in the inner city plummeted. So this is in the 60s. The inner city's gone from the 40s being an extremely expensive place to the 60s being a place that nobody wants to live because the prices are down, it's falling apart. All the work that was done to build the place up was done 30 years ago. So the inner city starts to become slums. They start to become what we, you know, still reference as the inner city problem, even though we've kind of flipped it again. So in the late 1990s, so 30 years later, so we got about a 30-year rolling effect that's happening throughout this. And it's fascinating to watch that sort of thing happen. A 30-year, that's about the living career span of a person in the United States. So come forward to the 90s, and you start having a slow influx into the inner city, and then you've got all kinds of names for this: gentrification, revitalization, the crime's too bad. I mean, Mayor Giuliani from New York is famous for noticing this trend and cracking down on crime. Now, the trend would have cracked down on crime by itself, because if people are moving to the inner city to make it better, they're less compassionate about crime. I don't know, less patient about crime, where people that are born there and they grew up there, this is just what they know. If somebody's moving to it, they're like, nope, this is not going to work. This is my neighborhood and I want to make it better. So the gentrification issue happened back in the 1920s. It's happened again from the 90s up through the 2000s. And here's the next headline. Americans push to the suburbs as city prices soar out of reach. So if you think of this as like breathing, inhale, outhale, exhale, outhale, inhale, exhale. The inner city has been inhaling. The prices in the inner city have been skyrocketing. What we're seeing now is that sales prices in walkable neighborhoods are up, while sales in walkable neighborhoods are down. Well, what's a walkable neighborhood? That's another name for inner city, close to a lot of services. You can walk to everything that you need. Just think of New York. Everybody's walking. So walkable neighborhood prices were up, even though sales are down. And places where residents need a vehicle to run errands, the prices are also up. They're up at a faster rate, although there's the difference across the country. Homes in walkable neighborhoods are on average across the country. There's a lot bigger concentrations in other areas. On average, $30,000 more expensive for the same house in an area that's considered walkable. Well, sales on those areas are down, tremendously down, and that includes the West Coast. You know, people think, well, unless you're talking about those West Coast folks, the Seattle and Portland and San Francisco, and nope. Prices are up in the inner city of all of those cities that I've named. Sales are down. More people are buying into the suburbs. What does that mean? Well, it means that we're continuing to do what we've been doing for the last 150 or 200 years. We move to the place where the convenience and the price balance out in a way that's optimal for us. People don't suddenly not want to live in a walkable neighborhood. They still want to live there. They just can't afford it. They've got to line their budget up. And now they've got to take a car somewhere. Well, that's going to increase traffic. So the city planning concept of Austin, of San Francisco, of any up-and-coming city that's saying, hey, we've got a massive growth rate, is how do we concentrate as much of our population in as small an area as possible so that we don't have lots and lots of traffic? We have the ability for people just to walk somewhere without having everyone have a car and clogging up all the arteries. Well, that's going out the window. It's getting too expensive. And if you've been to Austin lately, you'll see it. Try buying a house anywhere near downtown Austin. 10 years ago, the prices were a third of what it is today. And you can say, well, that was at the bottom of the recession 10 years ago. The housing prices dropped during that time period. Yes, they did. But not so much in Austin. In fact, Austin prices didn't have the big drop because they didn't have the big gain. So when you're talking about the reason why they didn't have the big gain is because in 2000, Austin was an up-and-coming capital city of a state. It had lots of tech stuff going on. But in 2002, we had another recession. People have pretty well forgotten about that. But when I say Arthur Andersen, Enron, they go, oh yeah, I remember that. Well, that hit the tech industry really hard. The dot-com bubble had a big chunk in Austin. So Austin city prices didn't go up as fast. People came into Austin from all over the rest of the country because the prices were too high, and then we had the Great Recession. Prices were fine in Austin. It's up and coming. There's a young population. Tech is kind of rebounding. So now we have this massive growth where the prices in some cases have tripled downtown over a 10-year period. That's unreasonable. People, you can't expect a continual tripling of real estate values every 10 years and people continue to buy it. You can look in Manhattan for that. You don't see it there. Any of the highest priced Tokyo, they maintain a very high price, but you don't see a massive appreciation there. They're going to maintain at that level. Really, really too expensive for most people, but they've hit their equilibrium. And now we're seeing shrinkage in New York. We're seeing shrinkage in New York City and in San Francisco for the first time, in Seattle and in Portland. You're seeing a slower growth rate in those cities. Austin's growth rate has slowed down. Well, why is that? Demographics again. Employment. People leave to go somewhere else when they don't have a job or when they think that they've got a better job lined up at the place where they're going. And this, none of that, no single part of that should come as a surprise. I mean, we knew that the inner cities got bad in the 1960s all the way through the 90s. In fact, I've got some pictures from my really early days. My dad was in the Army at the time, and we were passing through New York. And he took some pictures as we were doing that of the Bronx, of burned out cars that were literally burned out, just sitting on the side of the road, up and down the street, that had been there for years. We think of that today in the thriving metropolis of New York, and people go, "What? Wait a minute." The subways were covered in graffiti. So the trend that we're seeing is, I would expect in 25 or 30 years, the inner cities to be slums again. I would expect that prices have gotten too high in those areas. Now, there's areas where it didn't happen. So the slums in the Bronx didn't happen. There were no slums in Manhattan. Slums in Manhattan have never existed. And that's because any place that has the center of business is going to maintain. Any place that people are buying to live in so that they can get really close to the center of business is going to fluctuate because they're not living there because of there. They're living there because of what there is next to, and all it takes is a change in transportation. So the subway is really what helped to destroy the Bronx early on. It got easier to get from the suburbs farther out, Long Island and so on, to Manhattan, so people didn't need to live in the Bronx. And that's I get really carried away talking about this, because by looking at just that single pattern, just the one on demographics, we can start to gauge things like tax revenue to cities, to municipalities across the country. We can start to gauge things like crime. What we've seen recently is that the crime is no longer concentrated in the inner cities. In fact, it's been a flip. The highest crime rates are in rural United States, out on the farms, where you can go 40 miles without seeing a police officer, because the people have concentrated elsewhere. And this is an interesting concept. So you can predict tax revenues and tax changes based on those revenues, based on human nature. If the small municipalities just raise their property tax up through the roof, they're going to increase the exodus. People are going to leave faster. Another thing, And this is a big one. People think about this and they talk on a political level a lot. It's one of the major debates of the time. Gun rights. In the inner cities, where everything is very expensive now, the wait for a police officer when you call 911 is in the 1 to 3 minute range. Then the question of the inner city folks, and anybody that's listening to this is going to recognize this, why is it that anybody should ever have a weapon? Why should anybody ever have a gun? You can just call the police and they're going to be there faster than you can get your gun out of your safe. Unless you live in the rural United States. In many places in the United States, the police force isn't on duty in the evenings or on the weekends. And that's a shock to a lot of people. A lot of people get shocked by that. That, what do you mean? In my town, there's a whole police force and we have somebody on duty on Saturday and Sunday. Well, if you've got a town that's about 3,000 people, you can't really support a full-time, all-the-time police force, period. You just can't do it. So gun rights have taken on a heated issue. And you can say it's the two parties, it's Democrats, it's Republicans. And I'm going to tell you it's demographics. If you look at where people support gun rights, it's going to be in rural America. And where they don't, it's going to be in the inner cities. Because one person with a gun is a danger in the inner city. One person with a gun out near the farm is somebody that you would go to for help. So the demographics helps predict politics in general. I find that absolutely fascinating. If you just look at concentrations of people and what happens when people concentrate, you can start to build a bigger picture. You can build a picture of revenue, of income, of earnings. Companies do this. When they go out and do research to say, where are we going to put our headquarters? We're going to do it in a place that has, well, we want to have an educated workforce. We got to balance that with an affordable workforce. When they go out and they say it's educated, it's affordable, and there's enough people available right away to hire, that's how you make a business decision. This is all demographics. And I have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've got a follow-up question. I saw in the Wall Street Journal that Germany's floating 50-100-year bonds, and I think this week the Wall Street Journal said the U.S. was strongly considering that. I mean, who's going to buy a 100-year bond, or why would they? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. That is a fantastic question. That was actually the next subject that I had after this long diatribe about demographics. So I'm going to answer that in a rather indirect way at first, and then it'll become clearer. First thing I'm going to do is talk about the yield curve, because it's an important factor here. Yield curve, what is that? People talk about it like it's a curve in a road. It's a curve in a graph. You know you're in nerd world when there's a big subject with an exclamation mark on it that is referring to a graph. Well, welcome to nerd world. Interest rates are fascinating. Interest rates are on loans. So if you're receiving an interest payment, it means you've given someone a loan. People get shocked at that when I say, have you made any loans lately? And they say, no. And I say, how much do you have on deposit at the bank? And they say, $70,000. And I say, well, that's a loan. Your deposits at the bank are on the bank's liability sheet. They owe you that money. And they owe you that money when you show up. That means it's a callable note. You can call that money whenever you want it. That's the deal you made. That's why you get a low interest rate, because you could pick up that money and leave at any time. They'll give you a higher interest rate if you say, I'm going to leave it here for a little bit. That's the tradition anyway, because then the bank can turn around and loan that money out. If you say, I'm going to leave it here for 10 years in a CD, they can turn around and say, all right, I'm going to loan this money out to somebody else, and I know you're not going to come and ask for it again, or I have a pretty good idea you're not going to come and ask for it again for 10 years. So they can make a couple of five-year loans on automobiles and make some extra money on that money while they're paying you. They've got to maintain reserves. What we're seeing right now is that people are so concerned with people being people in general across the world and across the country. We're starting to see a great deal of concern about the next couple of years. And that's actually good news. I know I'll get to that in a minute. But it's good news for the long run that enough people are concerned that they're dumping their money as fast as they can into longer term vehicles. They're saying, I'll give you a loan, U.S. government, for 30 years. And okay, the interest rate's down. Everybody's trying to give you their money for 30 years, but I still want to give you my money, even though the interest rate is now paying the same as the 30-day interest rate. They're concerned, so they want to drop that money in there. Interest rates are really low. Well, what causes an interest rate to go low? Well, let's flip it to your personal finances. If you've got a low interest rate on a credit card, it's because that credit card thinks that you're a good bet. They want you to bring them your money, and they think that they have to compete against all the other credit cards because all the credit cards agree you're a good bet if you've got a low interest rate. And it's very uncommon to only get one offer at 0% financing. You're going to have your mailbox full of the stuff because they think that you're a great bet. If you're not getting lots of 0% finance offers in the mail, but you're getting them at 5%, or transfer over at 5%, and there's lots of them, it's because they think, you might not pay. And if you don't get even the 5%, if you're getting that higher thing and you're getting offers at all, they're getting dangerous. They're saying, all right, we're going to charge you a higher interest rate because you may not pay us back. So that's what governs interest rates. It's supply and demand. If you show up and four people want to make you a loan for your house, then it's an auction. It's an auction where they don't get to talk to each other to figure out what the bid is. They're just trying to give you the lowest offer that they can get in there so that they get the business. They still want to be profitable, but they've got a knowledge that they're in competition for your money. Well, that's flipped. In that the United States government has a lot of people competing to give it money. So the 30-year treasury, which up till recently has been the longest treasury, the interest rate is way down on that thing. We call that an inverted yield curve when the long-term rates get lower than the short-term rates. People are scared, so they're dropping the money in there. Well, who's scared? Who's doing this purchasing? It's still majority of the United States doing the purchasing, the U.S. citizens doing it. But there's a lot of other countries, including China, who the Chinese citizens are buying U.S. government treasuries because they're scared. Who's going to win in this trade war? Well, trade wars are won by the side that loses the least. There's no net gain in a trade war. If we get a trade deal out of a trade war, the net gain will be both sides. And that's something people have to understand. So Germany's talking about 50-year bonds and 100-year bonds. Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary of the United States, this week talked about introducing 100-year bonds in the United States. Apple's got 100-year out there. They're called century bonds a lot of times. If you can lock down a low interest rate for 100 years, you should do it. If you're getting a loan for a lot of money and it's at a very, very low interest rate, and right now interest rates at the 30-year level are way below inflation, that means it's a profitable thing for the U.S. government to be borrowing money at that rate. Where it becomes unprofitable is when nobody wants to make the loans anymore. That causes the interest rates to go up. Something really important about what Steve Mnuchin said is that he's talking about moving away from the 2-year as the primary source of funding. If you've listened to us for the last couple of years, this has been a point of concern for us, that the United States government has been borrowing a lot. This is the second year in a row we're hitting above $1 trillion. This is 2 years ahead of the political schedule of the budget deficit hitting $1 trillion. That's not good. we've got a lot to borrow. Right now, nobody's talking about cutting what we're spending. The Republicans are not. The Democrats are not. The Democrats want to increase spending dramatically. The Republicans want to increase spending slightly less, but still dramatically. Nobody's watching this. So the long term is, if we can get this debt financed at 100 years, we're not going to have to refinance that at a higher interest rate if interest rates go up for 100 years. So that's a fascinating and extremely, in my opinion, important facet of this, of the interest rates, is that we've been loading up on 2 years. The 2 year rate is not horrible for the U.S. government, but the problem is you got to turn around and refinance it in 2 years, because we're not paying off our debt. We're getting more debt. So the way we take care of a 2 year loan is we turn around and refinance it. We refinance it with the new debt as well. So we've got more new debt. If we look at the actual debt, revolving debt being refinanced and new debt, you get an eye-watering number in the multi-trillion dollars now. That's not good, because if interest rates go up, it can only be a very short period of time before we see a massive change in the budget based on higher interest payments. And the projections on that are not good to begin with, but refinancing at the shorter rate, or at the shorter term, is very dangerous for the United States government. It's the same reason why we tell our clients it's generally a bad idea to get an adjustable rate mortgage. You're going to be paying this off over 30 years, and you got to, if they can change your interest rate at any point, you might have a much, much more expensive mortgage. And the answer to that has been in the past, well, we'll just refinance it. I've got good credit. I hope people learned that that's not always possible out of the Great Recession. It doesn't matter how great your credit is if the bank doesn't want to give a loan. They have other reasons for not wanting to give a loan. Maybe they can't give loans. Maybe they don't have enough reserves on hand. Anyway, you look at it, you cannot guarantee that someone will be there in the future to give you a loan. So get a favorable interest rate for the longer period, and then you pay it off over that longer period. If we could refinance a whole bunch of our debt at the United States level for 100-year loans, that'd be great. I would be all on board with that. The demand for it may even be there. I mean, Apple did it, and that's amazing that Apple was able to get a 100-year bond out there and people bought it. I think the U.S. government could do the same thing. It would be worthwhile. The Germans are having a little bit of trouble. They had a longer-term Bund issue that didn't get filled up, and that's embarrassing. What does that mean? It'd be like if you go to buy a house and you make a big deal out of it. You tell all your friends, this is the house I'm going to buy. You talk to everyone in the neighborhood and introduce yourself and say, hey, I'm going to be your new neighbor. I've got this all lined up. The bank says, no problem, we'll get you the loan. And then you go to close, and the bank says, oh, we only got half the loan that you wanted. Could be a little bit embarrassing. Well, where are you going to come up with the rest of the money? Well, Germany's had to go to some other financing options to get that money filled up. So Germany's, the Germans are scared of the German economy right now. Germany may actually be in a recession. They've already had one quarter where they had a negative growth rate. And just think of that for a second. That's one of my pet peeves in economics, when people say negative growth. You can't negatively grow. You shrink. But we still call it negative growth. So Germany has been contracting. It's been shrinking as far as GDP goes, for one quarter at least. And we're almost through the next quarter. We won't know if that's been a contraction as well until halfway through next quarter. But it may already be in recession. There's quite a lot of Europe that may already be in recession. And if you go to the bank and you say, hey, I'm making less money than I did last year, and I'm borrowing more money than I did last year by far, are you going to give me a loan? Don't be surprised if the bank says, no, I think we'll wait and see how things go. And that's what the bond investors said to Germany this week. So if the Germans introduce a 100-year note or 100-year bond, it's going to need to be, hopefully, and not a negative interest rate, because most of their loans are out there right now at negatives. Or at least the new issues are coming out at negative. And that's part of the reason why they didn't fill it up. Well, the bank isn't going to make a profit on that one. Well, the investors of the bank. And I've got to play some commercials. I'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to call in and join the conversation, anything you want me to cover this week, I've got a lot of stories, but I do like having my mind helped with other folks. The number to call in here is 254-773-1400, and I've got a caller on 773-1400. Before I go to the break, I'm going to talk to the caller. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to say, when I was listening to the demographic talk, that I've shared this with other people. I know in the city it's called gentrification. I grew up in a rather poor rural area outside of Temple, Texas, and I've seen in the last 10 years our property values have tripled, and it's essentially called subdivision in a rural area whenever poor people were more likely to go to prison, things like that, are bought out, and their property values go up because people invest in their property.
That's right. That's right.
And thank you very much, sir. I appreciate taking the call, and I love the show.
Thank you. I appreciate the call as well. Thank you very much. So the divisions and subdivisions, this is an interesting factor when we look at demographics. I'm going to hit the commercials in just a moment. When was the last time you heard of a new city incorporating? And that's a big one. People think about that and say, I don't know. That's a change in our demographic pattern. And our city limits and the extraterritorial jurisdictions for the city limits are taking up a lot of the empty space in the middle, so that the city limits are slowly moving to cover everything. I think that's a short-term phase, short-term in the long-term historical look. So I would say this is over the next couple of decades you might see more of that. But the reality is that our population isn't growing fast enough for the rate at which the city limits are growing. The reason why the city limits are growing has been the reason why new cities aren't forming. The older cities are catching up and building in areas that they wouldn't before, or just claiming the land so no one else can. There's some problems there, but you can look at Europe as the last place that this happened. And hopefully we don't follow that pattern, or in a couple of generations, we're going to see a mass exodus to someplace like Mars. And that could happen. So I am going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. The phone number in here is 254-773-1400. I'll be back. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Thanks for joining. The phone number in here is 254-773-1400 if you would like to join the conversation. Got a completely different subject now. On the surface of it, someone might say, well, this isn't economics. What are you doing? It is. Just bear with me a second. The president just nominated Eugene Scalia as the Secretary of the Labor Department, the Department of Labor. Scalia is relatively well-known. His dad is the recently deceased Supreme Court Justice Scalia, Antonin Scalia. He's been an attorney for a while. He's worked with the Bush administration at the Labor Department level. He also worked with the Trump administration to knock down the fiduciary rule at the Labor Department level. So let me kind of give a brief timeline of this and what it means. Before the Great Recession in 2006, Republican-led Congress, the Pension Protection Act of 2006 was passed. In that act, Congress directed the Department of Labor to come up with a standard of care for retirement programs that was easy to understand at the fiduciary level. What's fiduciary mean? It means putting the customer, the client, their wishes way ahead of your own. That's a simple one. But there hasn't been a really good legal definition. And the Department of Labor says this is fiduciary and we're going to prosecute you if you don't follow this fiduciary standard. But they hadn't come out and said this is what the standard is. Well, 2006, Congress said you need to do it. Otherwise, you've got this big gray area. What's going on here? And this is a Republican-led effort. So they put in and they say, let's do this. Well, over the following decade and a half, the Labor Department has put out dozens of different versions that it's been pushed back and pushed back by the public or by Congress or by lobbying groups. They had a final rule that had been approved by the public. The peers had looked at it and said it's fine. The Supreme Court said it's overreaching. Well, Eugene Scalia is the one that took it to court. He's being put in charge of the Department of Labor. Congress has a mandate to the Department of Labor to come up with a definition for fiduciary. And I believe that they have pretty much said, we're going to punt this and let the SEC come up with something. Well, the SEC came up with something called regulation best interest, which is not a fiduciary standard, no definition of it, which means it's back in the Labor Department's hand. And if Eugene Scalia is in charge, the question is, would he recuse himself? Because he said some things that were pretty derogatory to the whole process. He was allowed to say it working as he did before, but as the head of the Department of Labor, he's got to follow the rules that are laid out by Congress. So there's a big question going forward there about his treatment by the Senate in the future. This is a big, big position, and it falls again into nerd world. How big it is really big. When the vast majority of the United States now has some type of retirement plan program where they're investing in it, that fiduciary standard would touch you. When I've got another caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a little off subject with what you're talking about today, but I just want to remind you and all your listeners about bankruptcy. Sometimes it's the right thing to do, but it runs your credit for 10 years. A lot of times that's okay, but I think y'all heard you say, they come at you with all, after you're done with your bankruptcy, everybody wants your credit now. They want to restore you back to labor.
Right.
And help.
Yeah. And I'll agree with you. The program before ours is Ed Laughlin's show, and he's a bankruptcy attorney.
I thought he was still handling. I'm late getting out here in the garage where I listen to the talk radio at.
Right. And what I can say about that is that Texas wouldn't exist if we had forever had good bankruptcy laws across the nation. Texas was founded by a bunch of people that were bankrupt in other states. Sam Houston, Davy Crockett, Jim Bowie. You basically go through the founding, the main founding people of Texas minus Stephen Austin, who was rich. And you'll find a bunch of bankrupt people. Well, Texas has historically had the strongest bankruptcy laws in the country, strongest for the people declaring bankruptcy. To say you have the right to do this and get back on your feet. One of the principles of America is that failure does not mean death. Failure means time to get up, brush yourself off, and do it again, only don't fail this time. And that's a huge part of the American dream. And this is something that's not true in the rest of the world. If you have two people standing next to each other, they're both billionaires. One of them has never worked a day in their life. They got everything they have because they are inheriting it from their long line of nobility. Whether it's a Saudi prince, you know, it's kind of cool. I got to meet a Saudi prince. That kind of concept, that's cool. But if a Saudi prince is standing next to Elon Musk, who has failed repeatedly in his life, or Warren Buffett, who has failed repeatedly in his life, who do you respect more as an American? The people you respect more aren't the people that just had no problem getting to success. They just got it. The people you respect more across this country, part of the American dream, are the people that failed on the way to success but still got successful. That word, get out of town, G-E-T, if you think about that word, it's a very simple word, three letters. What does it mean, get? Well, it means to bring something to you, right? Unless you get out of town. Now, how does that even work? Why is getting out of town different? And I'm not pulling that out of nowhere. GTT was a sign that people left on their doors when they left because of bankruptcies and so on and headed to Texas. Gone to Texas. Free land was available, and it had no extradition treaties with the United States for debt, for debtors' prisons. In fact, the Texas Rangers got into a shooting battle with the U.S. cavalry on the Red River when Texas was a nation, because the U.S. cavalry was chasing a chain of wagons that owed money back in the United States, and they were going to take them back and put them in prison. So it's very much like deadbeat dads today. There's no way you're going to pay your debt off in prison, because what they're you can pay it off. It's just going to take a long time. So the concept of how Texas started was as a way to get out, to get back on your feet, and to make yourself whole across the board. There's a lot of things that are said about Texas that if you look at what it was founded for and brought that sentiment forward to today, might change the way people feel about Texas. I'm kind of proud of the fact that the United States was founded by a bunch of failures, and Texas was founded by a bunch of failures. In any other part of the world, those failures would have been relegated to nothing jobs, unless they committed suicide, which is normal at the executive level in Japan. When you lose your job, suicide is the time-honored tradition. We don't hold that here. We say, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, get back into it. Bankruptcy is absolutely crucial to the health of our economy. If we don't allow companies to go bankrupt, then they'll never be profitable again. They'll just go completely out of business. General Motors exists because we developed a completely new form of bankruptcy that's never happened before, where the federal government stepped in and said, hey, none of you shareholders get anything out of this. But the legacy of General Motors can continue. It can find a way to move forward into success. And this is another news story. This week, the United States government is beginning conversations on what to do with General Motors. General Motors is still, in many ways, part of the U.S. government. They are beginning the process of divesting themselves of the last pieces of General Motors, and what's more, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So bankruptcy is needed. It's not pleasant. Nobody should go out and say, woohoo, I'm going to go get bankrupt. Or if you do, then you're probably not somebody that people want to have come back to the fullness of health. You need to take seriously the debts that you owe. But at the same time, when failures happen, they're not always, well, not always, quite often, not the fault of the person that's failed. And if you think about somebody in farming right now that have been farming for 25 years, they've been doing soybean, and they've developed good relationships with people in other locations across the world, and then the trade war hits, and nobody wants soybeans anymore, even if they weren't selling to China. There's now too many soybeans out there because other people were selling their soybeans to China. China's not buying them anymore. So now you're in competition with a bunch of other farmers that have too many soybeans. Your prices are going to go down. It was not your fault, but you failed. And farming bankruptcies are up 13% this year. If we don't have bankruptcy for them to fall back on, we won't have farmers. If we don't have bankruptcy for corporations to fall back on, we won't have corporations. We need a way to fail in a healthy way, to pay back what we can in that process, and to make ourselves whole. And we're about out of time for this week. I hope what I said this week was informative. If you'd like to contact the personal wealth coach off the air, we do give fiduciary customized investment advice to people of high net worth. The phone number to reach the office is voicemail during the weekend. Locally, it's 254-947-1111. And toll-free, it's 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. And we're actually thinking about who calls 800 numbers anymore. I mean, it's going to be on a cell phone most likely, so why is it even considered toll-free? We're still conversating about that subject internally. We have a webpage at thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com where we have recordings of the radio program going back about 7 years now. We have newsletters that we put out weekly. If you want to sign up for the newsletter, you can do it there. You can contact us there. You can read about our philosophy and see my made-for-radio face and our wonderful staff. You can contact us through the contact form or email directly at jake@tpwc.com. I'm sure Jeff would like to hear from you too. So jeff@tpwc.com. And until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. Thanks for listening.